Thanks, Jimmy. Good morning, everyone. My name is Chuck Beinhauer. I'm an alcoholic, sober by the grace of God and with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous since August the 9th, 1989. This morning, I asked God what he wanted me to do. And he said to tell people that he's here with us and that he loves us and he cares about us. If we ask him for help, he'll help us. And boy, every time I say that, I realize what a miracle this is because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was an atheist for the second time in my life. And I remember going to that first meeting. It was at, in the downtown section of Buffalo. I was practicing law, and it was held in a police precinct. And I walked in, I walked over there thinking I'm going to see, a bunch of lawyers and professionals, everyone all dressed up. And I walked in and it was the motliest crew I had ever seen in my life. There were people from every single walk of life, bag people and lawyers, doctors, professionals, blue collar workers, staff workers. And I was astounded by that. I couldn't believe it. But I sat down, I looked up on the wall, and I saw those 12 steps. And my mind was paralyzed from drinking, but I wasn't stupid. And I could see that these 12 steps involve God. And I thought I should just leave right now. What's the sense of staying? Even if I like it, after rejecting him twice, there's no way I would ever be taken back into the fold again. But I sat and I listened. And during the course of that meeting, something happened. I felt connected. I didn't know why, it didn't make sense. I didn't. Half the things people were talking about, I'd never experienced. But somehow I felt connected. I felt something in that room, something there that was, it was really amazing. After the meeting, this kind woman came up to me and she said, just keep coming, one day at a time. I said, you'll never have to drink again. And I said, well, this is sort of interesting. What do you think? How long do you have to do this for? She said, oh, honey, don't worry about that. She got a hold of my hand, said, don't worry about that. She says, you just need to come one day at a time and you're going to be okay. I said, well, I thank you very much, but how many one day at a times is it? Does this, are we talking about here? We're talking about, I said, a month, 6 weeks. Pretty smart guy. People can get it in 2 months, I can get it in one. So she looks up at me and she says, all you need to do, honey, is come one day at a time for the rest of your life. Boom. Oh my God, the rest of my life. What are you talking about? So I went home that night and I was with my still living with my first wife, although we had for all practical purposes, had stopped being married probably 3 years before that. And I told her about the experience. And she said, well, my therapist says that Alcoholics Anonymous is for people with weak wills, and you and I are strong-willed people, so we don't really need it. So, well, okay, well, then if that's what he says, then I'm going to go along with that. Now, mind you, I was in therapy, and my therapist had told me after every session for over 2 years, I would ask him at the end, what can I do here? What can I do to help myself? And he would say to me, have you ever tried Alcoholics Anonymous? Maybe you should try Alcoholics Anonymous. But my fear of what Alcoholics Anonymous had to offer overrode the tremendous gift that I was being offered. And I would go off and on from It was May or June of 1988 when I first went to that first meeting. And it wasn't until August the 9th, 1989 that since then I have not found it necessary to pick up a drink or to use any mood altering substances. But during that time, I never could get that first meeting out of my mind. And that somehow I felt something there that I had never felt it before. And I hadn't felt it as a child. I didn't feel it as a teenager, as a young adult. Didn't feel it in church. Didn't feel it anywhere. But I felt it there. And I feel it here today, right now, the same feeling. I feel like there's something in between you and me, each and every one of you in this room. There's a connection here. And it's that connection that kept me coming. My story is, yeah, it's pretty much the same as every other alcoholic story. I mean, there really is only one story, I think. We tried drinking, it went boom. And I spent the rest of my life trying to get back to that boom. I'd start out a night, and the first few drinks, I would be terrific. And then there would come a point in every night when I would just be trying to get back to that spot that, so when you go up a roller coaster, you go up there, those little tiny thing, ching, 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 you get right to the very top, and then you go over. I kept trying to get to right to that very top. I never could. I know today why I couldn't, because you can't. It was an illusion. It was part of my own delusion, my delusional thinking. In the course of my life, I lived in a way that Bill describes as selfish and self-centered. I used to think that's pretty harsh. Couldn't we come up with the better terms? But now I realize it's very kind, because what he could have said is alcoholics have the maturity level of a 3-year-old. If you've ever had a 3-year-old child, you might think back about those days. No matter what you did for that child, it was never the right thing. If they wanted a sucker and you gave them a sucker, they wanted two. If you gave them two suckers, they wanted popcorn. They would keep asking until there was something you couldn't give them, and then they'd have a pissy fit and temper tantrum and break whatever it was you got them, throw it out, not eat it. I mean, and that was my life. That's what happened to me. Except I was 40 years old when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you're 3 years old, that's not a bad way to live. The parents discipline you, they teach you the right way to live. They teach you about boundaries, and you learn about limits, and you learn to be content. I didn't learn any of those things. That wasn't because of my mom and dad. That wasn't because of my family. I didn't learn them because I know even at that early age, I suffered from the disease of alcoholism. When I was born, like all alcoholics, I had some fundamental differences that most people don't have. The first thing was I was born with an information bank. And that information bank is located, somewhere sort of towards the back base of my neck. And it's situated such that an idea can fly into that information bank and it can have no connection to reality whatsoever. And it enters that information bank and goes up, trickles in there, and gets up into my brain. It filters through my brain and it comes out of my mouth, and it's the God's honest truth. I could pass a lie detector test, and it may have no connection whatsoever, at all whatsoever to reality. That information bank is the vehicle through which alcohol talks to me. For those of you who don't know, when we talk about alcohol and AA, what we are referring to a spiritual entity. The liquid itself causes problems because I have an allergy to that thing, and if I start drinking it, I can't stop it. I just it's like a scratch. If you don't itch it, you'll be all right. But if you start itching it, you just got to keep itching more, and you can't itch it enough. Itch it till you start bleeding sometimes. Well, that's what happens to me if I put alcohol in my body. If that was my problem, then I would just stop drinking, of course. Why would I ever take the first drink, knowing that when I start, I can't stop? The problem is that I take the first drink, and I take that first drink because I suffer from a spiritual malady. And the malady that I suffer from is alcoholism. And the spiritual entity that I has more power than me is, we have named alcohol. Could have named it anything, but Bill named it alcohol. And so alcohol talked to me right from my infancy through this information bank. And I never saw the world as it really was. I saw the world through alcohol's eyes. And for the most part, that behavior is, it works very well. It keeps people away from you because they think there's something wrong with you. They're looking at the same situations you're looking at, I was looking at, and I'm seeing it one way and they're seeing it another. And they can't for the life of them figure out what the hell I'm talking about. But to me, it's clear as a bell. And I think I'm being misunderstood and they don't understand me, and they would just listen. I try to get people to listen. I thought the way to get people to listen was by talking louder. If you yell loud enough, they'll finally hear you. That never worked for me. It was very ineffective. But the second thing that I had was a set of was the blame thrower. A little blame thrower. It's a little gadget. It sort of runs along the side of my arm, and soon as something bad happens to me, the blame thrower kicks in, and it immediately points out why the people around me are wrong, why they're hurting me, why it's not safe. It's their fault. It's amazing that it was never my fault. I always had an excuse for what I had done, and it always involved someone else or something else. Could have been the government, could have been whatever. As I got older, could have been my business partners, woman I was dating, first wife. It's her fault. So that blame thrower is also a very effective tool for keeping people away. And the final tool, and I came out of the womb with these, was a pair of boxing gloves. Not necessarily physical boxing, but certainly verbal and emotional. And if anyone got close to me, if they could tolerate the lies, the insanity from the information bank, if they could tough through the blame thrower, I was waiting there with a pair of boxing gloves. And if you refused to stay away from me any other way, I was going to punch you in the nose or punch you in the heart. And those three tools, that is my alcoholic toolkit. It's the survival toolkit for an alcoholic. It effectively kept me separated, isolated, and alone my entire life. I was unable to connect with anyone, and I didn't understand why. In my mind, I was a pretty good guy. I just wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to help people out. Well, yeah, maybe I lied a little bit. Maybe I stole. Maybe I cheated. I cheated on girlfriends. Maybe I was mean. Maybe I might have been a little abusive. Just a little. I was controlling. Everybody's that way. And that was, I lived in that lie. I lived in that delusion for 40 years. And at the end of 40 years, effectively, had pushed away every person in my life. Anyone who came close to me, I tried to push away. The amazing thing about this, for me, as I look back on it all, is I didn't think it was that bad. I'd gone from Wall Street to Warsaw, New York. I went from a penthouse suite in East End Avenue to my childhood home. I went from a limousine to no transportation whatsoever. I went from a high lifestyle to the life of a bum. When I was sober a few years, I realized that homeless has nothing to do with an address. Homeless has to do with no connection. I always had an address. And granted, when I moved back from New York City to Warsaw, New York, moved into my childhood home, my father moved out, left. He had a job opportunity. He was retired. He had a job opportunity to go to Tennessee. And he did that rather than stay in Warsaw, New York. He did give me a roof. He did that. I went from a Wall Street lawyer to a substitute teacher in the high school that I grew up in. I lost the mental ability to practice law. I didn't know that. I remember my aunt came down one day and she's sitting in the kitchen with me in the house, and she looks across the table at me and she says, "What the hell's wrong with you?" I said, What do you mean? She says, "Look at you." She says, "You're a bum. What are you doing with your life?" I said, "Oh no, I'm hardly a bum. You know, I've jumped. I've gotten out of the rat race. I'm no longer a part of that crazy rat race, the politics and the fighting and the power struggles. I don't do any of that anymore. I'm just sitting here, and like John Lennon says in the song, 'Aunt Jean, I'm watching the wheels go by.'" She says, "Watching the wheels go by." She says, "You're nuts." She says, "You're crazy." "What are you talking about? I'm crazy. Don't you see it? I see what life's all about. I can now. I'm experiencing life. Of course, I can't feel anything because I'm drunk. Can't taste anything because I'm drunk. I can't smell anything because I'm drunk. Can't really hear anything because I'm drunk. But I didn't think it was that bad. Hell, I thought it was all okay. Would it have been nice to be with somebody? Yeah, that would have been okay. But small price to pay for this freedom. You know, there are people in this world who are truly ascetics. They live and they live with nothing, and it's remarkable, a tremendous act of faith. I was not one of them. I was a pseudo ascetic. I could make it look pretty good, but inside I was just falling apart. I was a wreck. I was terrified. Just what he says in Vision for You: terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. That described my life. Even in that state, I met a woman who married me. And she had no idea what she was getting into. None. So my aunt walked out that day and she said, "You can think whatever you want to think, but you're crazy. Get your act together. Go back to practicing law. What the hell's the matter with you?" Well, the truth was, I couldn't go back to practicing law because I mentally had lost the capacity to do that. And so long as I lived in a sea of alcohol, I would never be able to regain that capacity. I could substitute teach because I could teach one thing. I couldn't keep my mind on two things at once. And as a lawyer, you need to keep your mind on hundreds of things all the time. I couldn't do that anymore. When I hit my bottom, it was in New York City. It was 1979. My mother had died, and I went on a binge. I just continued. I was on a binge the weekend before she died. I was kind of a phone call that she had died, and I continued that binge. March 9th, 1979, her day of her burial, and I'm sitting in the funeral home, and I know that I can't remember really, and almost any, I have almost no memory of the whole week, none, like zero. And I know it's important. This is an important thing for people to remember. So I said, I guess I got to stay straight. I can't get high. I can't get drunk today. It's important. I need to remember this day. And this little boy, and I thought I can't, and I knew that I couldn't do that. It's like, Jesus, I can't go that long. But this little voice says, you don't really have to stay clean and sober all day. So just until the funeral breakfast, if you just stay clean and sober until then, you'll be fine. And I thought, that's true. Nobody really cares at the funeral breakfast. It's just a bunch of freeloaders. They're getting a free meal. They don't care. Then the little voice says, really, if you think about it, what the hell goes on at the cemetery? Nobody cares about that. As soon as that mass is over with, you can get high. I thought, oh, wow, that's true. And that's only, 3.5 hours away. Hell, I can do that. And I sat back in my chair. It's just this deep, wonderful deep breath. And I thought, oh God, okay, I can do this. I can do this. I can make it. And I felt good. And with that, I reached into my pocket. I grabbed a big chunk of black hashish, popped that into my mouth, and I ate it. And I was gone, just gone. I don't remember anything more of that day. I don't really remember much more of the next 9 months. I know that somehow in that process, I negotiated a multi-million dollar lease and moved a law firm from One World Trade Center to One State Street Plaza and set up the whole thing. I don't have really much of a recollection of it at all. But I remember one day when I got a phone call and I made a decision that would alter my life. That decision took me across a line that I had promised myself I would never cross as a lawyer. And for the next 3.5 months, I didn't sleep. I would maybe fall asleep for a few minutes here or there. Constant total blackout. December 14th, 1979, we called the off all of the attorneys and staff to the conference room, and I had the opportunity to address them and to tell them that they weren't going to get paid that day. We didn't have enough money to pay them, and I was able to tell them that they were not going to get their Christmas bonus that year, although they had all been promised a nice bonus. They weren't going to get it. There wasn't any money to pay them. And oh, by the way, in 2 weeks, the firm will be officially closed. You need to find another job. Merry Christmas. And that was it. This was a law firm with young lawyers, very promising, great clients, great faith in the firm, doing really good work. And that firm failed for one reason, and one reason alone. Failed because the managing partner of that firm was an alcoholic. And the managing partner was me. I kicked around New York City for another year. Finally filed personal bankruptcy on November 14th, 1980. December 10th, 1980, I moved back to my hometown. It took me 27 years of sobriety to realize that I never asked my father if I could move back. I just told him I'm coming home. God bless him, he didn't tell me you can't. God bless him, he didn't say to me, what are we going to do with all your furniture, all your belongings? This is a small house, it's already full. And by the grace of God, that problem was solved because the night before I was to leave, the moving van was stolen with all of my possessions. Now, ordinarily, that would be a shocking, horrific event for someone. When I discovered that the moving van was missing, had been stolen, the thought that came to my mind, and I'm sure this was from alcohol. So, well, isn't this wonderful, Chuck? You're even with the universe. 1967, you left Warsaw, New York with one suit and a suitcase full of clothes and went down to college in Washington, D.C. Coming back 13 years, 14 years later, and you've got one suit, one suitcase full of clothes. You're even with the world and you're even Stephen. You're coming back with what you left with. What I left out was the pain, the suffering, the heartache that I had caused to so many people in those intervening years. My neglect of anyone else's well-being, living solely for myself and thinking solely about myself, under the delusion that I thought I was this altruistic, charitable guy. I served on boards, I did all kinds of things, but it was always about me. It was never for them. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that the real meaning of love is when we willingly sacrifice our own well-being for the well-being of another. And in order to do that, we're given a spiritual toolkit. That spiritual toolkit is self-examination, meditation, and prayer. It comes as a result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Admitting that I was powerless over alcohol was it was a challenging thing because I didn't get drunk every single day. I was a periodic drinker. So I occasionally could go a few days a week, sometimes a month or 2 months. Say I was going to quit, I could quit for Lent. I learned this, that only alcoholics quit drinking for Lent. Other people have no reason to quit drinking, but only alcoholics. And I can't tell you how many times I quit drinking for Lent. It just seemed like a good thing to do. But I would be dying of thirst. Couldn't wait till Easter Sunday. I'd have that pitcher of Bloody Marys chilling in the refrigerator. I was sober a few years and I found out that Lent actually ends on Palm Sunday. I carried a resentment for years that I went that extra week all these years without drinking. What the hell kind of noise is that? I wasted all those weeks after Palm Sunday not drinking. That's crazy thinking. It's crazy thinking because my problem is how I think, not how I drink. Why do I pick up the first drink? Pick up the first drink because I'm an alcoholic. Bill says it so beautifully in his story. He goes to Towns Hospital and he finds out that he should never drink again. And because whenever he picks up a drink, he can't stop. The doctor tells him the theory about the allergy and the obsession. He walks out. He's a smart man. He says, "Man, does this make sense? I'll just never drink again. Why would I? Because I know that I can't stop if I start." few months later, he's back in town's hospital. This time, the doctor delivers an additional caveat in his message. He says, "Bill, you can't drink because if you start, you can't stop. But more importantly, your body and mind are deteriorating, and you're going to either have a wet brain, you're going to die. And you're very close to that, so you need to stop drinking." So now Bill and Lois are, Bill's a strong-willed man. He's a determined man. He's a self-made man. He certainly won't drink. He knows that. And so he leaves the hospital feeling terrific, and he's back again. And now he's hopeless. He says, "Jesus, I know I'm done. I know that if I go out of this hospital, I'm going to drink again." And he has a spiritual experience, and he never drinks again. And we need to have a spiritual experience. That's what I needed to have. And I got that as a result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have a white light experience like Bill. I didn't. Mine was the educational variety. But what happened was I had a change in the way I react to life. And so instead of making decisions that caused me to be restless, irritable, and discontented, decisions based on self, I try to make decisions today based on the well-being of the people in my life. My experience is, to the extent that I do that with no investment in it for me, I live a life of great peace and great contentment. I'm not restless, irritable, and discontented. Bill says in page 14 in the book, "Simple but not easy, a price had to be paid." What that meant was the destruction of self-centeredness. He says on page 25, "Hardly anyone likes the self-searching leveling of pride and confession of shortcomings that the process requires. The process is the destruction of self." And he goes and he says on page 20, "Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon the constant thought of others and what we can do to help meet their needs. That's a solution. If I don't want to drink today, all I need to do is think of others and not think of me. But as soon as I think of me, I immediately categorize everyone in my life by the way they are just disappointing me at that very moment. Whether or not they are, alcohol just builds this beautiful case of how everyone in my life is disappointing me. What they could be doing better, what they should be doing differently, what they haven't done, how they haven't recognized me for all the great things I've done for them. Immediately, as soon as alcohol sees that door open, bang, it's there. Sole purpose is to separate me from them. That's life of someone who's selfish and self-centered, and that was me. That third step, I made this promise to God. I said, "I offer myself to you, God, to build with me and do with me as you will." I hear people struggle about this all the time. Does God want me to take this job? Does God want me to buy this pair of shoes? I don't know whether or not to buy this, go on this trip. I wonder if God really wants me to. Well, if God wants me to go on this trip, I'll book the trip. I don't think God cares about any of that stuff. Really. What does he want to do with me? This is AA. I'm a person who can't not drink, and I'm not drinking. And I'm not drinking because of the grace of God. So I think what God wants every alcoholic to do is to just build AA. Go out and tell my story. That's it. I don't have to do anything else. I don't have to know anything. Just tell my story. Build AA with me. And the way he's going to do it is tell my story. He says, take away, relieve me of the bondage of self. That's the self-centeredness. That's the three-year-old thinking. Make me selfless. So it's, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Why? So that I may better do your will. So that I'm better able to build Alcoholics Anonymous. Take away my difficulties. My difficulties, he outlines on page 52 in the book, that the bedevilments, having trouble with personal relationships, I'm a prey to misery and depression, I can't make a living. There's eight of them. That's, if you want to know what alcoholism is, read those. That's it. There's not a word about alcohol in the bedevilments because I was living that way without a drink. But he took them away. He took them away in accordance with our contract for this reason. So that I can tell people that those difficulties have been removed in my life through the power and the love and living his way of life. And that's why I'm here today, to tell you that it's God's love and God's power and God's way of life that allowed me to get up today and not have a drink before 11 o'clock in the morning. And then the prayer ends with, "May I do thy will always. May I serve Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of my life." And I think that that's what we're asked to do. It's not a heavy lift. Tell my story. Get involved with general service. Let the world know that there's this place for hopeless alcoholics, people who can't stop drinking any other way. If you come here, we have a way that works for you. And it's worked for millions of people. It's worked for me. We're truly blessed. Once I make that contract with God in the third step, the next things to do, I need the self-searching. And that's the fourth step inventory. And I did the first three columns, and they were easy to do, really. It was all about all the people that I resented. And I resented a lot of people. Lot of anger, filled with rage, went all the way back to my childhood. And then I did the fifth step. And in the fifth step, I found out what I left out of the fourth step, which was the unwritten column in the book, the word column. Where was I at fault? What could I have done better? What was my mistake? Where was I to blame? My sponsor didn't say, "Chuck, look," what he said was, he told me his story about how he didn't think that he had harmed other people. And he found out that he, in fact, had stepped on the toes of others and they retaliated. And that's what I found out. I was the one who got the ball rolling. It wasn't until the fifth step that I was truly prepared to look at life from an entirely different angle. And so rather than look at it from a selfish, self-centered perspective in which I was the victim, I got the God's eye view of it and I saw that I was the perpetrator. I had started the problems. And these people were just reacting to a man who they couldn't reach, to a person who was incapable of connecting with anyone else, a person who was completely and totally selfish and self-centered. And I got relief from that because once I saw that, I could forgive all of those people. Forgive them all, every one of them, one and all, everyone on my resentment list, just forgive them. What a relief. It's the beginning of the end of bondage of self. I saw that I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief, prideful and angry and lustful and envious, and gluttonous and avaricious, and slothful. I saw that I was manipulative, abusive, and controlling, sober. I was doing the same thing sober that I was doing when I was drinking. And I learned in that sixth step that I didn't behave the way I did because of the way I drank. I drank the way I did because of the way I behaved. My behaviors push people away and make me feel restless, irritable, and discontented. And I think alcohol will take that feeling away. Never took it away, it just numbed me. I couldn't feel it. Alcoholics Anonymous takes it away. The forgiveness that came in the A step was remarkable. By forgiving all of these people that I had all these resentments for, just letting them go, I recognized the true power of God, that it was God who had given me the power to forgive. I never would have done that on my own. In recognition of the fact that God gave me that power and I accepted it, I did something that I never thought I would do, and I forgave God. I no longer blamed him for my circumstances, for the way my life was had worked out. I was able to forgive him with all of my heart. And with that came the greatest and most unbelievable forgiveness of all. I was able to forgive myself. And I could finally enter into the room of adulthood, where I could be responsible for myself and for the people around me, where I could truly think of others first and put their well-being ahead of mine. That is the expression of love. I think God is saying to us all of the time, "You are my beloved. How can I help you? You are my beloved. How can I help you?" And if I truly want to be on the same plane as God, if I want to live the life that God wants me to live, if I can carry that thought into every interaction during the day, I live in a place of great peace, great joy, and great love. To look each person in the eye and to say it to them, my heart to their heart, "You are my beloved. How can I help you?" is the greatest freedom of all. I had none of that without Alcoholics Anonymous. I can never repay Alcoholics Anonymous for what it gave me, ever. It's impossible to outgive AA, but I can try. And that's what I try to do every day. God bless you all.